As far as the talqeen is concerned, there is one hadith which the Shafi'i fuqaha quote in this regard. The hadith is not 100% authentic. It's not 100% authentic, it's in the Mu'jam of Tabarani. And this particular hadith, although it's not 100% authentic, but there's a rule about da'if hadith. As long as it doesn't get extremely defective, as long as it doesn't enter the realm of being mawdu' completely, then it is practicable in things which are not wajib and halal and haram and things of this nature. So Imam Nawawi rahmatullahi alayhi in Sharh al-Muhadha mentions this particular hadith, and he says this is one of those instances in which we make amal upon the hadith, admitting the fact that it is somewhat defective, but it is practicable. So if someone does it, there is no condemnation thereof. If someone does not do it, on the other hand, there should be no condemnation of that either. The problem comes in when one party starts condemning the other. When one party condemns the other, then we've turned the matter into an issue of dispute. It should not be an issue of dispute. Again, there should be what? The breadth of vision to allow for this to happen as well. And if someone left it out, he did not become a fasiq or a kafir on account of it. What he has done there is also a valid view. What that person has done on the other side is also a valid view. As for the dua after the Salatul Janazah, the dua that's made after the Salatul Janazah, to the best of my knowledge, I do not claim to have adequately scanned everything on it, but to the best of my knowledge, there is no specific evidence that says that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam made dua after the Janazah. However, the evidence might not be specific, but the generality of certain other hadith and qiyas upon certain other instances, ayyud du'a'i asma' Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was asked. And the answer that was given was dubur al-layl wa jawf al-layl wa dubur salat al-maktuba, in the middle of the night and after the fard salah. So from there, fuqaha have extrapolated. They have extrapolated from there to the janazah salah, because that's also a fard and this is also a fard to a certain extent. Now whether that qiyas, whether that case of qiyas is a convincing one or not a convincing one, some ulama have gone that direction and others have gone the other direction. If I'm of the persuasion that dua should not be done and I don't make the dua, then my brother should not condemn me for that. On the other hand, if my brother decides he wants to make that dua, then a dua mukhul ibadah. It is the essence of ibadah. If someone does it, fine. If someone does not do it, we should accept that as well. The problem comes in when I make it an absolute rule that dua must be made after the janazah, and those who did not make dua after the janazah have neglected the fard of the sunnah. That's when things get out of hand. So it is not one of the most important things. It's not one of the most negligible things either. Again, the level at which it exists, don't take it too low in importance. Don't take it too high in importance either. Both sides, when they do make the dua or they don't make the dua, they only have the best of intentions. Let it not become an issue about which we fight. The last one was what? Reading at the graveside. Reading at the graveside, there are some ahadith specifically about it. The authenticity of those ahadith are subject to question. There are some severe questions about the authenticity of some of those ahadith. However, we know from the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he stood around the grave, he gave the sahaba a command. What command did he give? Istaghfiru li akhikum. So often we recite the surahs, we recite Yasin or beginning of Baqarah and the end of Baqarah. Let's also remember that what Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam specifically instructed was make istighfar for your brother who's being buried now. Beyond it, if someone wants to read Quran, then comes in the issue of what? What you are reading, can it be of benefit to him? Now, the original view of Imam Shafi rahmatullahi alayhi is that أَلَّيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. The original view of the Shafi'i madhab is there's no such a thing as إِصَالُ الثَّوَابِ وَإِهْدَاءُ الثَّوَابِ. Only in three things. Only as far as Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam stated, إِذَا مَاتَ ابْنُ آدَمْ إِنْقَطَ عَمَلُهُ إِلَّا مِنْ ثَلَاثَ. The person dies, all his deeds are cut off. Only three things remain. The صَدَقَ جَارِيَةَ عِلْمٌ يُنْتَفَعْ بِهِ وَوَلَدٌ صَالِحٌ يَدْعُو لَهُ. Either a sadaqa, perpetual sadaqa, or ilm which he has left behind, which continues, or a child who makes dua for him. Originally, the view of Shafi'i is this, that you do something and transfer the thawab of something to someone else. However, the mutaakhirin of the madhab, from Imam Subki and others onwards, have adopted a middle position between that position of Imam Shafi'i there and the position of other madahib who permit the transfer of thawab. One person reads and then he transfers the thawab to someone else. It is a madhab of Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullahi alayhi, it is a madhab of Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal rahmatullahi alayhi, and Imam Subki and others have taken a kind of a middle position. So if it is done in the sense that, or the middle position Imam Subki takes is that I'm reading and the thawab is mine, I can't give it away, but then I make dua, ya Allah, give a similar thawab to what you've given me to that person there as well. Give a similar thawab. So if it is done in that sense, then it's a very good thing. Again, I want to draw your attention to what? The day when you come to a janazah and no one's reading Surah Yasin. The day when you come to a janazah and that particular verk is not made around, that verk sloan is not made around the qabr, is not something to be condemned. It is 100% in line with Sharia. The sunnah that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam instructed was, do what? Make istighfar. Stand there on your own. Make dua, Allahumma ghafir lahu, Allahumma arhamhu. Someone wants to read some Quran, bismillah, by all means read some Quran. Someone wants to make some adhkar, by all means make some adhkar. Whether people do it jointly, they do it individually, there should be acceptance thereof and no condemnation if they don't do it otherwise. Condemnation, as I said, will only lead to further friction in society. Wallahu a'lam. Any further questions? I think it's becoming quite late. It's already quarter to ten. Bismillah. There are situations like that. You find cases where one mother regards something as permissible and others regard it as haram. The reason for that would be that each madhab has a certain methodology. And in light of that methodology, the methodology adopted by madhab A leads it to a certain understanding of the case where he would say that particular thing is not permissible. The methodology adopted by party B leads him to a conclusion that very same thing which fulan with that party regards as halal, the other party regards as haram. The relativism within it lies within the methodology adopted by the two parties. It leads, this also happened amongst the Sahaba radiallahu anhu, where one party holds something to be halal, one party holds it to be haram. This has happened, it will continue to happen. It's all to do with how does a person reason his way out to that particular thing. Therefore, I mentioned an example earlier of the day of Banu Qurayza. Two different people, two groups of people interpreted the very, very same text from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the very words of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in two different ways. They understood it in different ways. One understood it, we would say, literally. Another group understood it figuratively. So a figurative understanding leads to a different act, and a little understanding leads to a different act. Sometimes there are certain things, speaking about halal and haram, there are certain kinds of foodstuff, for example, that one party would regard as halal, another party would regard as completely haram. Different evidence available and different methods of dealing with this evidence would lead to this kind of thing. Having the ikhtilaf is not a bad thing. Having the ikhtilaf, having difference of opinion is not a bad thing. How do we negotiate those differences? That's where it could become either good or bad. Remember, it's a test which Allah Ta'ala has placed upon us. What do we do? Do we then go on a campaign? Then it's wrong. Go against, on a campaign against one another, then that ikhtilaf has been a source, not of barakah, that ikhtilaf becomes a source of backwardness, a source of taking away the barakah that could have been potentially there. So it does come about that differences of this nature do exist. We wish it could have been that everyone is on the same wavelength and everyone agrees upon everything. But that is not to be, because Allah Ta'ala says, وَلَا يَزَالُونَ مُخْتَلِفِينَ. Had you wanted to, وَلَوْ شَاءَ رَبُّكَ لَجَعْلَ النَّاسَ أُمَّةً وَاحِدًا. All people, not just madhahib, Jews, Christians, Buddhas, Hindus, wouldn't have been there. Would have just been one ummah all upon the deen of haqq. But Allah Ta'ala had ordained it such. He says, وَلَا يَزَالُونَ مُخْتَلِفِينَ. There will always be these differences. Like we have been tested with so many other things, like we have been tested with greed for wealth, like we have been tested with desires, like we have been tested with all of these things, and we need to resist them. This is one of those things also where we have been tested with. We need to resist the temptation to launch into mutual slandering and attacking when these differences do occur. Once upon a time, the matter of appointing imams to masajid used to be a government matter. We had Amir al-Mu'mineen at the top, he had a government, and they would appoint who becomes the imam here, who becomes the imam there. We have now become a minority community in countries such as these. Each little community builds its own masjid, and then they elect a committee, and the committee appoints or employs an imam. So there are structures in place. There are most certainly structures in place. Whatever needs to be done through those particular structures that exist. If any particular person has a problem with any particular imam, then either he could address it through the structures that do exist. Alternatively, what he could do, if you have a problem with that particular person, go somewhere else and make your salah somewhere else. If it's only you that have the problem. If it's so many other people that have the problem as well, then it should be addressed through the structures of authority which exists in society. A masjid is a what? It's a waqf. And a waqf needs to have a nadir, a supervisor. A supervisor of the waqf. The waqf cannot look after itself. What do? We elect or we select or we appoint committees. These effectively become the nadir of the waqf. Part of what they do, they are the supervisors of the waqf. They administrate on behalf of everyone else. So they've become the ad hoc, not just ad hoc, but almost permanent authority for the affairs of that particular community. And one would assume that committees would act in a reasonable manner. and consider all the various complaints and things like that. The Imam himself must understand that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had harsh words for Imam Rajulun ya ummu qawman wa aktharuhum lahu karihun. A person who leads people in salah and most of them dislike him. All people will not always like their imam. Some people might have a problem. So when the bulk of the community, the larger section of the community has a problem with a particular imam and the committee does not respond to that particular complaint, they must look into it. Is it a valid complaint or not? If the complaint has some validity to it, then they must remember that they are entrusted with the amana of this community. They have to carry out this amana. They are carrying amana of public at large. If they don't adequately respond, then they will be responsible in front of Allah Ta'ala for that. But in our these particular structures, to start small-time rebellions and lead an insurrection again, that is not in line with what Sharia would demand from us. That normally leads to more strife than one was originally there in the first place. So it does happen that at times we have problems with it. Optimally, it should be addressed through these structures. I know that this is not a problem to which an answer such as the one that I've offered you here will provide all the solutions, because the variables and the amount of factors that come into play in a case like this, they're more than we can count on our fingers and our toes together. There's a lot of things. There are personal feelings. There are old scores to settle in communities. And then there's a matter of ability and inability and how abilities and inabilities are perceived. A person perhaps, to me, he reads very well. To someone else who's a qari of the Quran, he says, well, he doesn't read well at all. So I wouldn't even imagine that I can approach the complexity of the matter in a manner that will adequately solve it here. These are some very broad guidelines. And thereafter, there are some very specific issues with regard to it that will probably call for each case to be inspected individually with regard to all the factors that operate there, and then it could be solved. I cannot adequately answer that question sitting from here with the time and the amount of information available to me right now. Allahu alam. Bismillah. Slightly louder. Yes. The first and foremost thing that we need to do, I think, is a campaign of educating our youth who are entering into marriages about talaq. You know, we usually address the matter as ibuma klaha barsato. The problem has already occurred, then we address the matter. The first thing that we should do is before they get married, and this in fact used to be the method of our old imams. Before you get married, you come to the imam for a few weeks and you learn about nikah. In fact, there isn't much to learn about nikah. There's more to learn about talaq. Because once you're married, life goes on. There are a few things you need to know and then life can go on. The problem comes in with talaq. So we need to address this particular problem. And I would most certainly make a heartfelt appeal to the people in charge of this and other communities that as we teach them about hajj, as we teach them about salah and zakah, we need to teach them about the importance and the very, very serious nature of this thing called talaq. You could very well end up in a situation where husband and wife live with one another and they're living in haram, knowingly and sometimes unknowingly. So before starting to look for loopholes and solutions to problems, after the fact, if that young man and young woman want to go into nikah, they get properly schooled, you know, by us, the only thing that the young man come to learn is how to say qabiltu nikaha li nafsi bidhalik. And after that, he didn't learn anything else. And then he struggles with the qabiltu as well. He shouldn't be just be taught about the qabiltu. He should be taught about that ektalakyo, that he should be taught about. And the great injustice that he's perpetuating to himself, to his wife, to his children, to the extended family, those things should be imprinted upon him. Then inshallah, once that is in place, then we will never arrive at the juncture where you need to go look for Isri Talaq 1 or Isri Talaq 3. Then we can very well act upon the view of the Jumhur, the vast majority of this Ummah, which says a 3 Talaq are 3. And you need to bear the consequences of what you have done. It's because we sit with an uneducated public, an insensitive public, a public that is not sensitive to these particular concerns, that we start jumping ship now and then we start looking for solutions. Certain ulama will continue giving the fatwa that three talaq are one. That is a fringe view. That is not the mainstream view of the Ummah. The mainstream view of the Ummah, the vast majority of the Sahaba, Tabi'in, the Madahib, etc., all of them hold the view that three talaq are three. If someone would argue against us, but you know, we're sitting with this epidemic, then I say, let's do something about the epidemic. Not by, you know, just putting plasters whenever it starts bleeding, but by stopping to go to places that you get scratched. So, I think that's one way of addressing it. As for what do you do in the case, if someone come to me and said, look, I've given my three talaq, what do I do now? I say, well, as far as I'm concerned, as niyasi fa bayi fa yo. That's the matter in which I and the bulk of the Ummah understand the Sharia. If he thereafter would betake himself to a person who gives the alternative fatwa, I'm not going to interfere with him. He's made a certain choice which he needs to live with. I feel, however, that we cannot just leave the matter there. From our manabir, from our maharib, we need to address this issue and we need to hit at the root of the issue, the ignorance that exists around it, and the kind of problems, what would send the man into the kind of rage in which he just points at his wife and starts speaking words of talaq. That's one half of it. The other half of the problem is, you know, talaq, not forget talaq given in anger, talaq given in the state of intoxication. How much intoxication do we find in our communities right now? Once upon a time it was dakha and wine, and now it is stuck and all other kinds of problems. Are we going to continuously shove the goalposts, or are we going to do something about the root of the problem? I think we need to address the root of the problem. It might take 10, 20 or 30 years, but eventually it will bring us to a situation where we don't need to resort to these ruses and devices any longer, and we can come to where the jumhur, the bulk of the ummah, have stood all along. Any further questions? It is based essentially upon a practice of what? Again, the issue that I spoke about earlier, isal al-thawab. We do something, we do certain deeds of good, and then we send the thawab onto someone else. The original view of Imam Shafi'i was, your deeds are for you, laysa lil-insan illa ma sa'a. A man can get nothing except that which he worked for. Beyond that, can you do something, a good deed, and then transfer the thawab? The ulama have differed. The Sahaba Tabi'een have differed around this issue. The Shafi'i madhab stood here once upon a time, and then the later scholars of the madhab adopted the opposition which I spoke of earlier. So that doesn't restrict itself to any particular space in time. It can be done on the 1st, on the 2nd, on the 9th, on the 31st, on the 99th day, whenever. It's not restricted in terms of time. Earlier today we had a gathering here in which one of the shayukh showed us a quote from a particular kitab which speaks about the Sahaba radiallahu anhum. Early then on already, they used to have the habit of feeding people during the first 7 days. Not on the seventh day only, during the first 7 days, because in terms of this hadith, the mayyid is being asked, munkar and nakira, busy with him in the qabr. So they do something, inshallah, that thereby his plight might be lightened, made a bit lighter. So that speaks about the first 7 days. Thereafter, well, some of those ahadith speak of the what was it again? With the munafiqun for 40 days. Now, I would hope that, inshallah, our families that have passed away, they are not munafiqeen. So, but if anyone suspects that he was a munafiq, well, if he's a munafiq, nothing that you're going to do is going to get him out of trouble there, because innal munafiqeen fi ad-darki al-asfali min an-nar. Not for 40 days, for 40 years you can go on doing that, it won't help him. So during those first 7 days, there was the practice in terms of the riwayah of Tawus of feeding people during those first few days. We shouldn't restrict it to one particular day and only that day, and then the 40th day only. If you want to do something for the maid, do it without restriction in terms of that, because it will be a good thing. You do something of good, and inshallah, Allah will benefit that person. That's about as much as I would say about it. It's not a completely baseless practice. Just the method of doing something and passing the reward to someone else, or as Imam Subki says, making a dua that Allah Ta'ala, the same reward that is given me, give it to that person as well. The Shafi'i say reward is not transferable. Whatever was written to your account is yours, you can't transfer it. Other madhab say what's yours, you can transfer. So whichever way it goes, the Shafi'i say you can't transfer it, but I can make dua that Allah Ta'ala gives him a similar reward. The time boundedness, I have commented upon that already, Allahu A'lam. Anything else? Yes, bismillah. The second khutbah of Jumu'ah. Yes. Don't make the last dua. The dua, as far as Imam Shafi is concerned, the dua is one of the arkan of the khutbah, one of the necessary integrals of the khutbah. It can be as short as Allahumma ghafir lana, or it can be a long dua, whatever, but there needs to be some dua. So if dua was completely omitted from the khutbah, as far as the Shafi madhab is concerned, that entire Jumu'ah is batil. So the dua has to be made. Short or long, but some dua has to be made. Reverse, step backwards on. You know, we climb backwards or... Oh no, I don't know about the qaqara. No, I don't know about that. To climb the mimbar... So, excuse me, sorry. it occurring. Now, I don't know, I haven't come across anything. If anyone is aware of climbing the minbar backwards, please inform us. But I'm not aware of any basis for climbing the minbar backwards. Oh, like that. So he sits at the lower one, and while he's sitting there, then, okay. There is no hard and fast rule that he has to climb the other way around either. The point is that he has to climb the minbar. So probably for the sake of convenience, he just moved from step two, level two to level three. It is not a hard and fast regulation that he must climb in a particular way. Look, there are certain things which are ritual. Like, for example, qiyam, ruku, sujood in the direction of qibla, those are hard and fast. You don't have any. You can't say how it's supposed to be, because sallu kama ra'aytumuni yusalli. That is ritual. You must do it like Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam did it. But then there are certain things which are not rituals. Which are not rituals in that sense. So, if the salah is finished, you know, you want to walk you want to walk this way out, you want to walk that way out, the ritual has come to an end. You have a free choice of doing that. The climbing of the minbar is one of those things as well. If you go to the books of fiqh, they wouldn't prescribe a particular way. You know, it must be like this, and then like that, and then like that. This is an ada. It is it's a common act. So, if a particular khatib, you know, is sitting there, and then he just reverses one step upward, he hasn't done something greatly wrong. But what we do know is Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to climb the minbar, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam just got onto the minbar and delivered his khutbah. There was no lecture before the khutbah as such. That is something which we have developed for our particular purposes here. So an imam who sat on the second step and then moves from there upwards, he's facing a new situation which didn't exist in the time of Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam was on the minbar already for the khutbah and for nothing else. So you'd climb with his back to the community behind him, and if someone would want to do as Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam did, which is what we should do, and not just that, but just about everything else, then by all means do that. But if he is already on the minbar and now he feels he's going to step one up, it is not the violation of a very, very important rule. Yes, it's not quite the way that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to climb it, and he should not make a habit of doing it in that particular way. Should not make a habit of it. Should not make a habit because it is always better to do things the way Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam did it. So he should not be unduly condemned for it. He should be nicely admonished to say that, brother, or imam, or sheikh, maulana, you know, the manner in which you're climbing is not 100% in line with the sunnah. Turn around and take the step upwards, and inshallah that should solve the problem. There are certain times during the day when one should not make salah. First of all, the time of istiwa. We generally refer to it as zawal. The proper term is istiwa when the sun is right at the zenith. When it falls from the zenith, that's called zawal. When it's right at the middle, that's called istiwa. During that time, you should not make salah. There is a difference of opinion in the madhab whether it is makruh to make salah during that time, whether it is haram. The carried view, the preferred view being that it is haram to make salah during those times and not just makruh. The other one is while the sun is coming up, while the sun is setting, a number of times like this. But there's one exception to that general rule. If it's a Friday, then that rule doesn't apply. Second exception to that rule, if you're in Makkah, that rule doesn't apply. It doesn't apply there. This is going to be one of the touchstones of testing whether there's enough, number one, awareness, and secondly, accommodation. What do I mean by awareness? It's a Hanafi masjid, for example. Well, the masjid is not a Hanafi masjid. Anil masajid alillah. They're Allah's masajid, but the imam and the community there, they generally Hanafis. So, are they first of all aware of the fact that to a Shafi'i it is no problem to make salah during those particular times? You know, I see in your masajid in Johannesburg, they got this. I don't see it here. I can see it's a Shafi'i masjid. They don't have that zawal light on. So, they have that light, and you know, when it's on, don't make salah. Now comes in a Shafi'i person and he makes a salah. Two questions I'm going to ask. Is the imam and the community, are they suitably aware of the fact that this person follows a different madhab in which it is not considered to be non-permissible? Secondly, are they prepared to accommodate the fact that someone else is following a different practice? We need to spread that kind of awareness. As long as we don't spread the awareness, then it will continue happening in this manner that someone comes in and everyone jumps down his throat. He shouldn't jump down his throat. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was sitting with the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, and in came who? The Bedouin. And he goes into the corner and starts urinating in the masjid. These Bedouins come from the desert. They don't have the same refined manners of of town dwellers. They will urinate anywhere. So he goes into the corner, and Sahaba radiallahu anhu jump up and they start, almost reprimanding, almost pulling him out of the masjid. And Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, no, leave this man. Let him continue. No one would like to be interrupted when he's in the middle of relieving himself. Let him continue. Because look, there's two things now. One of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to keep the masjid clean, throw him out, or you're going to break the heart of a Muslim. It's more important not to break the heart of that Muslim. So let him continue. He can always clean that. But once the heart of a Muslim is broken, once a person has been hurt, you're going to have problems there. So Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, after this person is done with it, he calls him. And then he explains to you in a beautiful way. If the same hikmah would be used in cases like this, first of all, the awareness be brought about, we say, Mawlana Sheikh, I'm a Shafi and my madhab, it says that if I enter the masjid on this day, as we make tahiyatul masjid, is a sunnah muakkada, even if it's a particular time. And the imam on the other side says, welcome to our masjid, brother, by all means go ahead and do that. That brings the rida, that brings the pleasure of Allah Ta'ala. On the other hand, if we start condemning, plucking him out and say, what is wrong with people like this? Why do they do things like this? That is serving the cause of shaitan. That is serving the cause of driving people further apart. So there needs to be this kind of awareness. And that awareness would spread from where? I think from where? From the madaris where students are taught. There must be sensitivity to the fact that our communities, there are people of different madahib. There are Shafi'is here as well. There are Hanafis here as well. They do it differently. Let's be aware of the differences and let's be prepared to accommodate them. But it needs to be done with gentleness. With gentleness, so many things will fall into place. مَا كَانَ الْحِلْمُ مَا كَانَ الرِّفْقُ فِي شَيْءٍ إِلَّا زَانَهُ. Whenever there's gentleness in something, it becomes beautiful. And if the gentleness is taken out of it, then it's not the deen of Allah any longer. Then it's serving the cause of shaitan. As right as it might be, but it's not doing it in the proper way. Just so that no one takes any wrong kind of impression. Yes, that's an important thing. Don't make a skull spell of yourself also. You go there and the khatib is standing there on the minbar and you come in front of the khatib and you say, Allahu Akbar, tahiyyatul masjid. And you make louder, nawaitu an usalli tahiyyatul masjid. What are we trying to do really? I mean, do you want the whole world to know that this is the way Shafi'is do it? No, this is not the way Shafi'is do it. This is not the way Muslims do it. We need to be sensitive to everyone. So what Sheikh mentions there is very, very significant. Don't be in your face about it. There again, gentleness and kindness is required. Consideration for the other. If both, once upon a time, Imam Qaffal Marwazi was a great Shafi faqih. He was called the Sheikh of the Tariqa Khurasaniya. And in his masjid, he was the Imam. And so what happened one day, a Hanafi faqih passed by outside. And he called him in. Come, brother. No, he passed by and he came in. He saw time for salah. He said, Bismillah, come in. So Qaffal Marwazi asked him, Sheikh, you lead the salah today. You're a Hanafi, but you lead the salah today. So he's standing on the musalla now to start making the salah. Imam Qaffal is going to make the iqama. What did he do? He made the iqama like a Hanafi does. For Allahu Akbar, stu, ashadu an la ilaha illallah, etc. And the Hanafi faqih is standing there in front. He says, MashaAllah, you can accommodate me. So he made the salah in the Shafi'i manner. The one accommodating the other in this particular way. If I'm not saying that we have to do exactly this, but the spirit of this kind of cooperation, it's not a one-way street. It's not just that Hanafis must give in to Shafi'is or Shafi'is give in to Hanafis. What Sheikh mentioned, very significant consideration from both sides. Don't do things just to show people that here I am. Don't go into the Hanafi masjid and go, Ameen. That's not necessary. A slight Ameen will do. On the other hand, a friend of mine went to a masjid in a place that I will not mention, and as it would be, the Imam says, غَيْرِ الْمَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَبْضَالِينَ. And as the Imam is saying, وَلَبْضَالِينَ, we Capetonians already taking the breath for that Ameen. And as he's saying, Ameen, someone in the Jama'ah, in Salah, shouts, no Ameen, no Ameen. That is the opposite of it again. So we shouldn't do that one, we shouldn't do that one. Right in the middle, inshallah, with sensitivity, with gentleness, inshallah, in this way we can bring the rahmah of Allah Ta'ala, we can bring the barakah that this ummah needs for our ship to go forward, for our deen to spread. لِتَكُونَ كَلِمَةُ اللَّهِ الْعُلْيَا وَصَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَى سَيِّدِنَا وَمَوْلَانَا مُحَمَّدْ وَعَلَى آلِهِ وَصَحْبِهِ وَسَلَّمَ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد الهادي الأمين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. اللهم اقسم لنا من خشيتك ما تحول به بيننا وبين معصيتك، ومن طاعتك ما تبلغنا به جنتك، ومن اليقين ما تهون به علينا مصائب الدنيا. ومتعنا اللهم بأسماعنا وأبصارنا وقواتنا أبدا ما أحييتنا، واجعله الوارث منا، واجعل ثأرنا على من ظلمنا، وانصرنا على من عادانا، ولا تجعل مصيبتنا في ديننا، ولا تجعل الدنيا أكبر همنا ولا مبلغ علمنا، ولا غاية رغبتنا ولا تسلط علينا بذنوبنا من لا يخافك فينا ولا يرحمنا يا مولانا يا رب العالمين. إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما. اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وأصحابه وبارك وسلم. دعواهم فيها سبحانك اللهم وتحيتهم فيها سلام، وآخر دعواهم أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.